Hello, and welcome to episode 104 of the Be Yourself and Love It podcast with me, Anthony Samaroff, on the Conscious Resistance Network. I'm really excited about today's guest today. His name is Fred Tly. We actually spoke 7 years ago or something like that when I was doing the Scottish Liberty podcast. The audio on that was not the best, but I was so proud of the conversation that we had and actually what Fred was doing. He's now since retired from the Oregon Prison Project, where they were actually in prisons teaching prisoners nonviolent communication. If you've not heard of nonviolent communication, we'll definitely get into that soon. I imagine quite a lot of you have. But what was so remarkable about it was they were finding that the prisoners on this program were tending not to reoffend at the same rates as people who hadn't gone on it. And I felt like that's very inspiring to me because I like to think that everyone is reachable. And if you can get to the hardest to reach people, which we tend to think are criminals, then maybe there's hope for all of us. Fred, it's so good to speak to you again.
Well, thank you, Anthony. I'm really excited to talk to you again. I really enjoyed our conversation last time.
Yeah, me too. So let's hear a little bit about it. Like the what was the Oregon Project? And then we'll get into a little bit about you. And then I guess we'll dive full force into the whole shebang.
Well, the Oregon Prison Project was in response to many of my students in my public classes asking how could they learn to teach nonviolent communication. They would get excited and excited about what was possible in their lives, and they saw a way to contribute to the well-being of people and communities around them, and then they would and then ask how could they do this on their own. And so I quickly discovered that I needed a teaching practicum. I needed a practice lab for people to use their teaching, their new teaching skills, and to be able to create deeper relationships with people. Sometimes people who they would not normally connect with at all in their lives. So there was a lot going on that they could process in learning their new skill, communication. And so I was simultaneously asked to start a program in the prisons. And so the prisons became that teaching practicum. At one point, we had four adult prisons, one and one youth authority that we were offering classes to here in Oregon, and 30 volunteers teaching 14 classes a week. So,
Wow, that's
go ahead.
yeah, that's a consider well, no, just wow, that's a considerable impact. Go
Yeah,
on.
it was really fun to have all those people who were so excited and willing. The little secret about that is that the people who learn the most are the volunteers. Right?
Right, of course. Of course.
The people attending classes in
Yes.
prison have usually been there for a while and have decided that they no longer want to be there, and they've been doing programs for a while, some of them 10, 20, 30 years. And so, you can imagine teaching nonviolent communication to somebody who's been meditating 30 years. It's a
Oh wow, that's impressive. Yeah.
joy, a pleasure for somebody who's not re hardly reactive at all as a result of their own practices, right?
Oh wow. Wow, that's really considerable. Okay, so for those who don't know, nonviolent communication, I think I came into contact with it around 2012. Although I really wish that I'd known about it when I think the book Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life came out around 2003. But it did have a very profound effect on me. I'm a counselor, a psychotherapist, and I feel like reading the book Nonviolent Communication set me off on that path. I started, it's a book that teaches communication skills for the resolution of conflicts, both assertion skills and listening skills. And I really started practicing the list. Chapter 7 was called Receiving Empathically. And I really put that into practice in my own life. And I saw massive results with my friends, and I was like, wow, this is something that I think is really useful. I might want to get more into this. And so when my degree finished, I went along and I did a postgrad in counseling studies in Edinburgh University, and the rest is just history, as they say. Why don't you tell me how you got into nonviolent communication and the effect that it had in your life?
Well, I had a very nervous personality, a very anxious, and that anxiety was not necessarily one of the best ingredients in a calm and peaceful relationship. And so I had gone through many relationships and many relationship breakups, and I was with a person at the time who was a teacher at a Waldorf school. And we were struggling, and everybody knew. And at the same time, the Waldorf school was struggling, and everybody knew. And so they had invited a couple of nonviolent communication trainers to come and do a workshop for us. And they invited, it was for all the instructors, but they invited me along as well, knowing that I might benefit. So I can remember being halfway through the second day with just tears running down my face, right? Tears of relief that it wasn't that I was born broken, that I couldn't do the job, right? It was because I had learned something that wasn't working for me. I was seeing the world through a defensive lens, right?
Oh,
And
right. So when you heard that concept that you could actually learn to communicate a different way and be less defensive, it brought you to tears because the revelation was, oh, this is something that I've just learned to become. This is not something that I have to be.
it wasn't a permanent curse, like you were
Right.
cursed by the magician at birth, or something.
Right.
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 And it was permanent until, there's something magical happens. But in this case, something magical had happened, right? That realization that I was telling myself a story, and I could tell myself a different story. And I was very, very skilled. I had learned thousands of things that I did really well, and I knew I could learn this. And so this was relief, right? And then the other half of my tears was sadness, because I was 52 when I took this
All right.
workshop. I was like,
Wow.
oh, we could have wound this one back 30 or 40 years, and I would have
Yeah.
been had
Yeah,
a
if only
different
I'd
life.
learned this 30 years ago. If only I learned this 30 years ago, I would have saved myself a lot of pain and heartache and difficult relationships and what
And save other
have you.
people, like
Right.
I'm very active, and I tend not to sit back, so I'm going around bumping into people unskillfully and causing a lot of pain. And so I have a lot to grieve and feel regret and mourn.
And when you, as you practice nonviolent communication first in your personal life, what were the first things that changed that you saw as an indication of, wow, I'm really onto something here?
The moment I stopped playing a particular form of game in relationship, right? When someone would say, you're wrong, or that's bad, right? This is like a serve in tennis, right? It starts the game of right, wrong, ping pong, right? And so And I would just beat it back, in my old habits. But when I stopped doing that, I noticed that it created space, right? That all of a sudden the person had no idea what to do next, because I wasn't playing a regular by the rules, right? I was doing something else, and I also discovered that just not doing that, not reacting in my usual way, right? I felt much more calm and open-hearted, as it took.
Yeah. Please go on.
So it took a lot of practice to first notice when I was reacting, and to notice earlier and earlier and earlier, right? So I didn't st even start up, right? And then just to remain calm, take a couple of breaths, walk around the block, splash some water on my face, and come back and be present to the person.
Right. And one of the things that I've noticed, I think, having the skill of knowing that when you get into conflict, rather than mount the case for why you're in the right and the other person is the wrong, knowing you could say, well, you sound really upset about that, or I could see why that would make you angry because X, Y, Z, or it sounds like when I said X, you thought that Y. You've got these, like, you can reflect back to the other person something of your understanding of what they've said. One thing that I've realized over the years that does for me is I feel like I'm preparing for a conversation a lot less. I don't spend all day going, well, if they say this, I'm going to say that. And if they say that, well, then I'll tell them this, which I think, it takes a lot of energy. But when you know that you've got the skill of empathy in your back pocket, and that most of the time that takes a lot of the charge out of a potential argument, it makes you more comfortable going on to situations, knowing, thinking, I think I'll be able to deal with this. I think I'll be able to handle this, whatever happens.
Yeah, I have a similar experience. It's being able to trust yourself, to trust yourself to stay in place and not get pulled down that same road. And so you're calm and peaceful and can carry the empathy. We use that as a word, but the way we express it is curiosity, right? To be
That's a nice
curious.
way to
Oh,
do it.
yeah, what's going on with that person? In fact,
Yeah.
I've been saying, oh, sounds like you're having a bad day, right? What's going
Yeah.
on, right? You want to tell me about it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So first you saw that and you saw that this was beneficial in your own life. And at some point you thought, well, I mean, this has helped me. I want to teach other people. And that was the next step.
Yeah, I was 52, and at that time, I was mostly doing a lot of building. I did custom home building for years, and my body was starting to tell me, you're just a little bit too old to enjoy this. And so I was just gradually slowing down. And but at the same time, I was also noticing that my heart wasn't in it anymore. I d just didn't have passion for it, and that I was looking for something different and something I could do sitting down. So I thought, well, I'll become a psychotherapist, right? Or at that, I hadn't asked that question of myself at that moment I took that first workshop, right? But once I finished the workshop and asked the folks, what is this? How do you do this? How do you get involved? And they described the simple process, and I could imagine myself having a different kind of career and more in a helping profession.
So then you started to teach people and they wanted to be teachers, and that's the Oregon Prison Project was born. You said you'd got asked to come into prison to teach. How did that transpire?
Well, I have taught other things in my life, environmental sciences and building and cabinetry and those lots and lots of different things. And I knew that the fastest way for me to learn was try to explain what was going on to other people. It would really get me to go over it in my head and to see my personal relationship to it, and then ask myself, what is going to be most accessible to other people? And so I simply told myself that if the phone rang and somebody was asking me to teach a class, I would say yes. That would be the deal. That was the deal I made with myself, right? So the phone first rang about 3 hours later, after making that agreement with myself. And it was a friend of mine named Jed who was doing a class with men that were on probation in domestic violence cases. And what they were, their part of their probation was to attend a year-long class. He didn't have anything that he was doing that he was happy about. And he had seen some videos of Marshall Rosenberg working, and decided that he would like to offer that to them, and then discovered that I was available. So
Wow.
I did that work for 7 years. And
Right, 7 years.
Yeah.
So you were in the prison for 7 years teaching
It no,
nonviolent communication to criminals, or
yeah, it that was 7 years before. That wasn't 7 years before the prison project started, but that was
right.
a class outside the prison with people who were not jailed, but they had a relationship with the
Oh,
justice system.
okay.
Right? So that's how I
Right.
connected with the justice system.
Oh,
Yeah.
amazing. And what was the typical attitude of people who'd come in through for your nonviolent communication class from the justice system?
Well, pretty much everybody, these are typically younger people, and they were angry, tended to be angry. And I would say their willingness to be accountable for their behavior was somewhat lower than I would have enjoyed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so there was a really large learning curve for me to learn to hold on to any judgments and outrage and things that I might feel about how someone else was treated, right? Especially those who we agree to honor and respect in our lives, that we bring close to ourselves. And after working over and over again with my own, I decided that the best thing that I could show them is not to be reactive in the same way that they were with their partners.
Oh, okay.
And bring it back to the quality of relationship that they wanted. I mean, what do you want in your relationship? Right? How would you like it to go? And those that would say, well, yeah, I would like it a little bit different. They could be worked with. Right? And there,
Right.
you could never tell when something would touch somebody, right?
Right.
There was one person who, he just attributed everything going on in his life to other people. And in
Right.
learning the concept of needs, that you're working from, that everything that you do is working from a place inside of yourself of something you're longing for. That you work at there, that you're actually working in that territory. And for him to say, oh, I did that because that's what I was looking for. And then the simple question is, well, and how'd that go?
Right.
Hey, you're here in this class, right? And what were you looking for? And it's like, oh yeah, I wanted peace and harmony and joy and happiness and excitement in my relationship in my home. He said, and you did something that brought you here. I don't want to even know to know what you did, but you're as a result, you're in you're in trouble here. And how is that for you? And he says, oh, not so good, right? And
Right.
then the question is, well, what do you imagine you could have done differently? And produce the outcome you were looking for. And then it's often like, well, I don't know. I don't know how to do that. And I'll say, okay, well, I'll show you.
Right.
I found that when we found what they were looking for and what they were longing for, right, and simply offered it up, that many of them, the far higher percentage of people, would be willing to take it out of my hand rather than
Right.
any effort that I might make to tell them they should.
So at some point there might be a turning point where someone would see that if they learned new skills and make better decisions, their life could go better. And you'd see that turning point, and then they start engaging more constructively with the class.
Oh yes. So
Right.
the basic principle that right out of the nonviolent communication book is everything anybody does or says is in service of their needs.
Right.
And they may not understand the global nature of this, how big this statement is, right? That means that you can't attribute your state of being to everybody, to anybody else. It's something that's coming from you.
And so you might have a very poor strategy for meeting a need, right? I mean, if I want companionship, let's say I have a need for companionship. I might think I might meet that by going out to a bar. Now, there's no need for going out to a bar. I mean, it might seem like that way sometimes. It definitely does seem like that way sometimes in Scotland. I need to go out to the bar. But actually, that's just a strategy for trying to meet a deeper underlying need, whether it's for connection or for excitement or novelty or, something that we all share. But it could be a bad strategy. It could be, I have a need to feel respected, so I'm violent or dictatorial at home. That doesn't get me. I think it's going to get me respect. I think it's going to convince someone that they better speak more respectfully to me. But the underlying need is not met if actually wears away at the quality of my relationships with my spouse, with my children, for example.
Yes, exactly. We had one man named Jack who we were working on the difference between requests and demands. In our culture, we use demands, right? And I want you to do this, right? That's a not giving a person an option, right? Like that kind of thing. And he was in the class because of a way that he had asked his partner to do something. So one of my teaching tricks is, hey, does anybody here like to be told what to do? And they're like, oh yeah, man, no, don't tell me what to do, man. I'll just, well, I'll take care of that, right? And then my next question is, well, then why do you think your partner does? And so Jack just had this moment. It's like, oh, well, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if she does or not. I said, well, go home and ask her. And so he goes home and asks his wife, and he comes back and he's got this big grin on his face that's also mixed with lots of embarrassment, right? That's like, well, I asked her and she told me. And they had decided to do something different in their relationship about how they made agreements, or but
That's good. It must be so inspiring when you have stories like that.
yeah, every once in a while it's just too easy. It's archetypal, right? Like this is the and I don't plan that.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. So what did the syllabus look like? Did you have to get people in at first and just sort of do a kind of pre-form group therapy, or did you have very specific things that were you, well, I mean, where you could model your skills, or did you have very specific things you wanted to teach in a syllabus? Like how what forms did these classes take?
So I took an example from my own life, and I was in a leadership program with an organization in San Francisco, Oakland Bay Area, the Bay Nonviolent Communication. And it was a year-long program. And at the end of the year, I mean, we met for a long weekend monthly, and then a couple of weeks in the summertime. And I watched my own development. And then I was invited to teach basic classes with BNBC. And so I started learning teaching. And this was in my second year while I was taking advanced classes. And I realized that, while I learned the structure, the framework of nonviolent communication in a very, very short time, remembering to that I wanted to use this set of tools in relationships took a lot longer, you know, for me to consciously notice my reactivity in all of the places I was doing it, and quite extensive. And so there, it was 2 years to a place where I could have confidence that I could stay present enough to show people what the possibilities are of learning when you learn nonviolent communication, because the goal, if there was a single word to say it, is presence, for you to be able to become present to the world around you and not reactive. And so I was up to 2 years, and I was starting to say to myself, well, to have this be a truly relaxing experience where I have integrated it and it's unconscious. I'm simply doing it out of my deepest understanding and practice of being and being present. So to get to there, it looked to me like about 4 years. So the program, so I had all my notes for that, and then I just wrote those up. So the first years are the basic structuring and practices of the you know, the more what physical level thing. And then the second year was pretty much lots of coaching others, and then empathy circles, lots and lots of empathy circles. So a person would have a chance to practice their curiosity over and over again with a really broad diversity of people. And then third and fourth years were more learning to teach others, right? Supporting others. And then after 4 years, I would certify a person in the prison to our program, and they could teach in our program.
Once they'd been on the program for 4 years, once they'd been...
Yeah, and moving in their fifth year, they could, they had been student, they would be teaching with another facilitator, and student teaching up until then, but in their fifth year,
and these were inmates.
Inmates and people from the community.
Okay, so some people presumably, when you told them about when you came in and you told them about nonviolent communication, in a very short time, they're like, wow, there's something here that is of value. I want to get in on this. And they're the kind of people who would end up wanting to be instructors, or was it unpredictable?
Yes, it was typically the people that moved the fastest were people who had already made the decision that they were going to do something different in their lives. One of the men, we were invited from BNBC, the people in the leadership program were invited to teach in San Quentin Prison in San Rafael, right? A big prison in the North Bay, really old California prison. People would come in and come into our circles, and they would describe the way their lives had gone in prison. They would say, like, there are two kinds of people: knuckleheads and cons. The knuckleheads are the ones that are playing the same game that brought them in to begin with. They're being the tough guys, and they're going to fight it out. And they said after 5 or 6 years, that attitude sort of starts getting worn out, because nobody puts up with it, right? And then they decide to change and do what is necessary to try to make the most peaceful and cooperative and beneficial environment they could make in a prison, right? This is what their lives would be if they had a long sentence. This was going to be the rest of their lives, right? And so to choose, they made this decision to choose to craft a different kind of relationship. And then they were looking for tools. So often they had done yoga, they had been meditating for a while, there's other classes, and they come in and sit down, and they were already heading down the road. And there's also a game that inmates or adults incarceration, I think are the is the words these days, right? Right. And they call it the get out game. That basically they're trying to do whatever they can to get the parole boards, if they have parole. Determinate sentencing slowed this down somewhat, but they were trying to convince the parole board to let them go. And sitting in our classes, those playing the get out game would slowly realize that they were really going to have to be able to craft cooperative relationships and be able to hear people non-reactively, and that they weren't going to convince anybody. The usual conversation of trying to convince the parole board that they were good people was just never going to work for them, because the parole board didn't care anything about being convinced. They just wanted to see somebody able to do what was necessary to live outside. So if they can remain empathic and remain non-active at a parole hearing, right at the gate, right? This is where they say yes or no, right? If you could, in that very high ante situation, if you could stay there, then the parole board is like inspired, and they might let you go out of their own inspiration, that they could trust that you could do what it was. You know? So this is the, we got a testimonial from the parole board that after a while, they would notice that our graduates were curious about them, right? Because you know, there's five or six people in the room, and none of them have ever taken nonviolent communication classes, and they're all speaking very judgmentally.
Yeah, and so yeah. Go on, please
yeah.
continue.
Well, like the district attorney from the county that the crime was committed, would you typically be sitting there with members of the victim's family? And the DA would say, well, I don't trust that you're ever going to be different. You know what? How horribly these people were affected, you know, and just, you know, like all, because they only see the person once every 2 to 4 years when the parole hearings come up. And so they've had no change in relationship with that person over that period of time. They haven't seen them grow or change. So they're in the same place that they were whenever the crime committed. Right. So it's the same person. So the district attorney is protecting them in the best way that person knows how, but out of information that was only from the past. He hasn't seen him either. Yeah. You know, a bunch of words on a page. Right. Yeah, this guy's great. No. But if a person can stay curious and like, right, hey, you're really worried. Right? You want to be able to trust that this isn't going to happen again if you let me out of here. Like, you've done a lot of work, but I think you're just playing a game. I think you're just trying to fool us, right? Yeah, and you want to, you want to know that this is real for me, and that we can all trust it. And the important thing is to stay with empathy for them until they stop, until they have expressed all their longings, right? And then ask them the question, well, what can I do right now or in the next time should I stay here that would inspire trust in you? I mean, what could happen? And the moment you could see a member of the parole board start to think about that question, then that person has experienced the curiosity and accepted it as genuine, right? So, and that has started them down the road to trust. Trust is based on good accounting. So.
Yeah, because let's just imagine what might happen otherwise had they not received the NVC training. You know, they go and up before the parole board, and someone's saying, well, I mean, you've disrupted the life of those families so badly. I don't trust you're going to come out here. Either that person... you know, thinks, wow, these a-holes have really got it out for me, you know, and you know, they become, no, and they start trying to convince them. The worst thing you can do if you want to convince someone is try really hard to convince them. No, I have changed. I've done this. I went on this. I've been in, you know, That's not very convincing. Or on the other hand, oh well, what do you know? And that I can imagine would be the typical response, not just from inmates, but from most people when they're kind of put in that position of being interrogated and being told to prove themselves.
Exactly. If they haven't done anything to change their idea of what a relationship game is, right? And I call that right wrong ping pong relationship is war, right? It's simply that the whatever you're discussing has been reduced to polar opposites, and that's all you're talking about is none of the nuances, none of the intricacies. It's just simply black and white. Now, that is, as a psychologist, as a you probably heard the mammalian fight and flight response, right? And one of the yeah, and one of the symptoms of the mammalian fight and flight response is to reduce everything to its simplest possible terms, so you can decide in a moment whether you're safe or not, right? Is that the stripes on the tiger, or is that just dappled light on a bush? Yes or no? That's all I want to hear. Yes or no to that question, right? Because if it's a tiger, that's going to go badly. But if it's stripes on a bush, light on a bush, no problem. Yes or no? No nuances, or you don't want anything in between. We just want that very quick and simple thing, right? When things are dangerous, right? So if you're playing that game in conversation, if you're playing that game in your relationships, that's an indication, a symptom that you're constantly activated. So meditation techniques that contribute you to your ability to observe what state you're in and address it inside of yourself as you go. I love Vipassana meditation for this, right? Great skill. Like what? Just let me put my attention where I want to put my attention, right? I want to put my attention on the content of my thoughts right now. What is going on? My body is like I'm tense. I'm feeling I have clenching, and my breathing's a little bit faster rate. And what I'm doing is looking around and being a little bit jumpy. And what I'm telling myself is that there's danger here somewhere. But just to simply notice those things in real time and not react to them. That's a wonderful skill to have. Because
A very liberating skill.
it's a life. It is,
Yeah.
absolutely. There's very few
It's horrible being reacting to everything that happens all the time.
Exactly, because you're the person that you're in front of and reacting that way to, it immediately they're on the same page, right? Well, it's dangerous, right? They're looking around for the tiger as well, right? Right,
Well,
and it's and
I heard
looking
it
at
said,
you, you're the yeah.
yeah, I heard it said, if you've still got buttons, you're still a robot. So,
What's
and
that?
somehow, if you've still got buttons, you're still a robot.
Oh,
And
yeah.
somehow, people somehow have the way of like, they can smell where your buttons are sometimes, and they'll know exactly the thing or saying or thing to say or do to get you right where you have a trigger. On that point, did you? I hope you don't mind me asking. I suspect you won't, but it's a bit of a it's a strange question. Were your parents still alive when you started to learn NVC? And I would say, have a reason for asking that.
Yeah, no, they weren't.
Oh,
And
I'm sorry if that. Yeah, go on.
yes. Well, in my family, that was going to be the highest mountain to climb, right? Like
Right.
it was always an attack zone. That's where I learned mine. And then I went into the service, and that just added icing onto the
Oh,
reactive
that didn't
cake.
help.
Yeah,
Okay.
so.
I've got some friend, colleagues, associates that have been in the service, and it is like, I mean, if you're ever going to be trained to, I actually myself had a dispute with friends of mine who were in the service, and it was very difficult for me for exactly the reasons that we discussed earlier on the conversation. When I go into an argument, which doesn't happen very often apart from around family, which is why I was asking, because that's the biggest mountain. I've got these skills. I know to say, first of all, I'm sorry about A, B, and C, right? I know that if I admit where I've been at fault, or at least say, okay, I didn't mean to do that. I can see why you'd be angry about it. If I I know that that already takes a lot of the sharpness out of a conflict. So having known about these skills for over 10 years by this point, I'm not per I'm far from perfect, but I've got a couple of well-oiled tools to bring out when I go into a conflict situation. It was very difficult for me because it seemed to me like my friends who were formerly in the service could not say, okay, I can see why that would upset you. At all costs, they had to give no quarter, right? They couldn't say, like, gosh, Anthony, I'm really sorry I saved over your work. I could see why that would be annoying, right? And that is like, it's not even, you don't even have to take on blame for it. So, I mean, what do you, like, have you experienced, I know you've spoken to a lot of people who are learning NVC. One thing is, for the main part, it's been a benefit. But one thing I find for me is a deficit of having counseling skills to search my soul is I can get really, really annoyed and upset where I'm in need of empathy and I know exactly what I need. And the other person is unwilling or unready or lacks the skill to give it to me. Like, it makes me more annoying now. It makes me no more annoyed now than I was before I even learned this stuff. Because at least before I learned this stuff, I couldn't say, I couldn't say, why don't you just paraphrase? Just paraphrase what I'm saying and just show me that you understand what I'm saying. Do you know what I mean? It's that much to ask. Right.
Well, this is the
Any
frustration.
experience with other people complaining about this?
It's well, there's the whole Center for Nonviolent Communication has a list of differentiations, right, for those that want to become certified, right? And this one is needs, not strategies, right? So you brought your need to be heard to a person who can't hear you, right?
And I try not to do
And
that
so
less and less.
if you keep doing that, then we get to play the Sigmund Freud game of anything that you do, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again don't get a different outcome, that's crazy. That would be crazy.
I might have been harsh on a couple of people who couldn't hear me in the past before I learned that I just need to know who's good at that. And go to them and maybe not go to certain other people. But it could be difficult. And like I said, you don't always get into a conflict deliberately. But if you're going into one and you've got these skills and if you make some concessions, I don't see them as concessions. I just see it as demonstrating my understanding of what the other person has said. Likewise, I'm hoping the other person will go, all right, well, I didn't do that on purpose. That means they don't need to take blame for it. They don't need to take blame for it, but they go, I can see why that might upset you. Oh, all of a sudden I feel much better already because at least they say, if I was in your position, I'd probably be pissed off too, even though I didn't mean it. So I'm not like, but that might be a lot to ask. So as we go on, we want to be better at providing ourselves with this emotional first aid.
Yes, and part of that is to kn know who can do it, right? It's nice to have a little black book that you can open up, right? Oh, I really need some empathy right now. Oh, I'm pushing, on my phone, I'm pushing star one or something, right? That my first emergency contact person, right? That that you can really trust that if they have the opportunity and time at the moment, that they can connect with you. Because
And
but this is a really good sign, because it means you're on a continuum of growth, right? Now you can handle some people some of the time, but not all people all the time. And you know,
Like
there's
it.
yeah.
Yeah, and I think obviously the reason why I brought up your family was because, as Ram Dass said, if you're still if you think you're so enlightened, why don't you go and spend the weekend with your parents? They know exactly where your buttons are because they gave you those buttons. So this is like I'm really enjoying the conversation and it's taking so many deep turns that I wasn't anticipating. We might go back into the prison system now as a topic. And what maybe talk a little bit about the attitudes of inmates coming in. Some people didn't want to be on the course, some people chose the course voluntarily, and what you tended to see happen over the course of their tutelage.
Yeah, about 50% of the people that came into the course initially dropped. No one was,
Oh, 50% of people dropped out the course.
about half of them.
Right.
And no one was mandated, or at least officially, no one was mandated. But when I would ask people in the class, who are new people at the beginning of the year, right? Why are you here, right? Many of them would do something like, the parole board told me I had to take the class, or my counselor, a case manager is what counselor means in prison speak, right? My case manager just said I have to take the course. Not that I had to, but I had to. And so, yeah, so it was worded like, you take the class, you might get out. You don't take the class, you're never getting out, right? So their need for
Well, that is testament to how that's testament to how effective they came to know your methods were.
because
Fact that they,
they're coming to the class because they're watching other people who have already been through the class, and how their lives are developing, and how they're treating, and how their lives are on the cell blocks, and those kinds of things, right? That's a very different thing.
Amazing. And then how would you deal with that situation when someone said, I didn't really want to be here, but my caseworker said I better be if I how would you bring them in?
It would be something like it's just standard you recognize as standard empathy, but it sounds like you don't want to be here, but it's better than the alternative for you. And like, you know what'll happen, it'll never loosen up and I'll never get out of here. Yeah, it sounds like you really want out. You got family outside, and like, yeah, I got a wife and I got kids. I've missed their birthdays, right? It's like you really miss your family. And just to show people what's possible using just plain English language, right? Because here's the secret of nonviolent communication that it isn't advertised, right? Nonviolent communication is not for you to use. The structure of it is not for you to use with other people. It's to train you to a quality of presence, and equanimity that you can be open to relationship to other people, and then skills to actually construct a relationship at this present grounded basis with other people, right? It's a teaching tool for you, right? So we
I feel
disguise
sort
your
of
growth as what's happening in our class, learning the four steps and the two sides of
Those are just a framework like that just dissolves away. I wouldn't say I'm an expert at NVC, especially the assertiveness aspects of it. I kind of see it as like, you'll see a knight with a sword and a shield. Like there's the empathy and there's the assertiveness. And I definitely practiced more of the empathy skills than the assertiveness skills. And that's probably to my whatever the opposite of credit is, because I could really use those assertiveness skills sometimes. Although empathy is an assertiveness skill, because by being empathetic towards people, you warm them up to being more receptive to requests. But let's just not overcomplicate things. What I would say is, even though I'm not skilled in the NVC method, I think during that period of a year or two before I went to train to be a professional counselor, I internalized the precepts of the empathy skills. And so I would use them. And a lot of, I actually still use the, what I call a formula. I still hear it coming out of my mouth in sessions and even with friends and family, because it becomes part of who you are. It's not just a communication skill. You know, it sounds like you're feeling X because Y. And I won't necessarily say because you need Y, but you know, like I will have that element to it. And what I've noticed is, and a lot of counselors will say, "How do you feel?" Or they'll say, "How do you feel about that?" Or they'll even be reluctant to suggest, "Do you feel, it sounds like you feel angry about that?" Because in their training, they're told, "Well, you know, don't prime the client, or you know, just ask them how they feel." But what we learned from NVC is that a lot of the time people don't know how they feel. So if you suggest something like, it sounds like you feel quite guilty about that, they might go, "No, I'm not guilty. It's more like I feel ashamed of myself because X, Y, Z." And what I like about the AB, the it sounds like you feel X because Y, or such and such happens and you felt Y about it, is they can correct either part of it. You might get the explanation right, but the emotion right wrong. Or you might get the emotion right. Yeah, I do feel guilty, but it's not because of that. It's actually because of this. And I've always found it so helpful the way that people light up, almost as though they don't even notice that you've suggested anything. They just have this internal check. Anthony is saying that I think and feel this, let me check it against how I'm actually feeling. No, that's not quite. Oh, yeah, that's exactly it. And then they can go deeper. Or, no, that's not quite right. Let me correct you. And by the process of making a suggestion, you actually help people understand how they feel better. I always think that was a complete magic trick. And discovering that is probably what set my life down the path that it's gone down, even though, you know, I'm not an expert in NVC.
Yeah, that's the basic skill that makes all the magic, right? To show enough curiosity about a person where they actually believe that you're curious, right? They believe that you're interested, right? And if they can trust that you're
And that might
interested,
start as a
yeah. They'll tell
yep,
you
you might
then.
fake it till you
Yeah. Here it comes. The waterfall, the
here it
cascade,
goes.
the plug in their experience that they've been holding back just opens, right?
Yeah, exactly. You just it's almost like even when people are defensive, they're just holding back almost because they're scared that if they start, they won't stop.
Yes,
So I thought
which
this
is
was going to be
true.
a
Well,
pot.
that's a really good point, because that's true. That people are afraid that once they start, they'll never stop, because they want it that badly. They want to be seen. They want to be heard. They want to be
They want to be
understood.
seen.
They want to be embraced. They want to have a sense of belonging to the world, because they're desperate. The whole fight and flight thing simply says, you don't belong, right? That's the basis of all the fight and flights. That's what goes on in your head when you're in that place, right? You don't belong. You're by yourself. You have no surroundings. This is it, right?
Yeah,
You're
there's no
out
one
on the
here.
ice
No one's,
floe.
no, there's
Yeah.
no one's on your side. There's no one here to help you. You're gonna have to,
Exactly.
you know, you're gonna
Yeah.
have to fend for yourself. You can't tell anyone anything, because if you tell them anything, they might use it against you, and that'll make you in even a
Tell
worse
them,
position.
yeah. And empathy carries the specific message: you belong.
That's beautiful. So let's get into, I feel like we're whetting people's appetite to learn more about this, and maybe we can even talk again in the future. I thought this was going to be a conversation on prison reform. And I, but I love when things just become, but that's one of the wonderful things about open and authentic communication. It's kind of like having a kid. You don't know, you have all sorts of ideas about how you're going to parent and shape them and what they're going to be like, but they kind of come out with their own personalities. I just relaunched this show after 2 years of hiatus. So that's kind of what I'm doing with the show as well. I'm kind of like allowing it to become what it is instead of putting confines on it. Well, speaking of confines, while I am here, go on,
Okay,
tell
go
me.
ahead. Well, what
No, you go first.
you can think of it as we are all prisoners to our own reactivities. We're all prisoners in our own minds, right? So it's prison reform, even though you can't see
It is
the bars for the vast majority of people.
beautiful.
You could, but they when they're walking in the door, they're bringing their reactivity, and their biggest question is, can you help me not live this way?
Right. And I just saw a most beautiful meme on Facebook yesterday, which was two cellmates in a cell, painting a picture. They were both looking out the same window, but one drew the bars and the other drew the trees behind the bars. And I feel like, yeah, it's the sort of aspiration as to, what can we do while we're in the prison yard? You've certainly got me thinking about those ways that I'm still reactive and how I want to deal with them in the future. So what did you see? And you had data, I think. What, like the people who went through your program in terms of recidivism rate, that is, for those who don't know, the reoffense rate after having gone through a nonviolent
Well,
communication program such as the one that
we
you were
never
doing.
measured that, right? We were, in order to be able to do a research project and actually do those things, right? We would have been we would have needed to be associated with a university and then have researchers that were signed up for this and then written a grant and then gone through internal review boards at both the university and the prison system and all of these other kind of things. And I was busy getting a doctorate at the time and going through that, I decided that I never ever wanted to do that kind of work. Because it wasn't producing outcomes that I was looking for. It would simply ask questions about their effectiveness. And I could see it. You know, I could see the people change. And I also knew that they're in a context, right? They can learn a skill and a consciousness in a context, but when you change the context, you know, it's a new field in which to use those old skills. So you got to be engaged in transference. So, right, this was going to happen to everybody, and that my the best thing I could do was to make sure that their skills were transferable to the extent that I possibly could, and that I didn't want to take the time to do that whole th other thing, and it may not have been possible anyway. So we never measured recidivism, and recidivism is a crummy statistic anyway.
I know.
Everybody measures it differently, and it's just, you know, it's a
It's
it's
kind of like, I think what you were doing is very authentic and human. It's walking into people's lives and saying, here is your invitation to open up to a different way of being in the world. And then you potentially, I mean, I definitely have a site. I love data. I love studies. I love, please prove to people that this works so that more people will do it. Well, in some ways, you take the humanity out of it and you make it dehumanizing by turning the people you're trying to teach into test subjects so that you can wave the papers up in the air and say, hey, look, we've saved the prison system money and these people aren't reoffending and you guys should, they then become pawns in a bigger game, rather than, rather than humans who are, this is a very, this is a very, it's like a one-to-one thing, nonviolent communication. It's about opening up to being in the moment with people, and the transfer of energy happens, and then they turn around and walk away into their own world, and you turn away and walk into your own world, but neither ever the same again. And to try to reduce that to a figure like, oh, look, people didn't commit as many crimes after learning this, it's a little bit crass if you, for in some way.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense to me to play the academic game. That wasn't what I understood to be an effective strategy to produce the kind of peace in the world that I was looking for. And the prison is an ideal place to have classes. They got time. The fact that you come in is it in into a prison. You have to choose to come into a prison, and it's an effort to show up. Nobody's paying you, right? And so for them, it's like, oh, you guys care. It may be imperfect, but you actually care. You see us as human, and just that amount of empathy does about half of your work.
Were
Remember
there
when I
some
well,
people?
You remember when I said that like
Go on.
50% of the people dropped out? Well, you might see them back the next year at the start of a new class, right? So effectively, over time, only about 25% of the people dropped out and never came back.
People just weren't ready for it yet. It was too much of a challenge
Yeah.
to how they saw the world. They dropped out, and but they couldn't stop thinking about it afterwards. So they'd have to come back around the next time
Yeah.
because, yeah, because they caught a glimpse of something which was undeniable.
Yeah.
And then there's other people who maybe they never came back and you don't even know what's going on in their head. It could be this is stupid, but it could be something as simple as if I accept that this is true and this is useful, then I have to accept that my whole life is wrong. I mean, all sorts of things like that. I don't want to go into too many details. I'm involved in the natural health world as well. And people have told me examples of going to mainstream doctors with non-mainstream treatments and saying, here, this works for your condition. And the person's saying, you know what? I'd rather not try this treatment protocol, even though I'm terminal, because if I did and it works, I will have to accept that I've been practicing medicine wrong for my whole life. So this is more fundamental than that. This is
Yeah.
like the way that I have been, I may have been responsible for screwing it up with both my wife's and all my kids and my own family and things like that. So it could be very challenging to people to discover that what you teach in your class is true.
Yeah. And what you're discovering in your class is true about you, right? Like this is your own truth. All of those places that you've guarded it, right? Because you, like you described, you couldn't hold it. You weren't holding it, right? You've got it locked away someplace. All of those, they're invitations to presence, right? You're being invited to. And this is why grieving it becomes very important, right? The mourning
Can you
and
say something
the.
about grieving effectively, if nothing else, for my own benefit? Because I still often find there's things from long the past that still cause me emotional pain.
Well, if you have things to grieve, you are in emotional pain, right? There's a wonderful book by an author named Martine Pretzel, and it's The Smell of Rain on Dust. And he makes the point that you feel grief to the extent that you love in your life. You may not, and
I
there
must
is
have
a,
loved a lot.
yeah, you must have loved a lot, right? And still do, because the truth about life is that everything changes and that everything you love, you will lose. This is true. And you just grieve that idea, that truth, right? That it's going to happen. It will be there. And there's other things. There's environmental grief. There's, all those parts of you that didn't that you expected to be to receive love but that didn't get it, et cetera, et cetera. There's
Right. Yeah, the achievements you thought you would make by this age in your life that you may never make, you know. That hard to believe, but I'm never going to be an NBA player, you know, at 5 foot 3. So right. You know.
Sometimes it's a little more amusing to give up than others, right? But yeah,
Yeah,
so
some of, yeah, exactly.
grief is a very natural, or can be a very natural part of our experience, and should be an active part of it. Like, there are cultures that simply in the village there's a hut, and that's the grief hut, and it's running 24/7. And anytime you show up, you can cry and you can wail, and the medicine people will do whatever they do, all the way from drug-induced wailing and crying, and to simple to ritual-induced, right, mesmerization for all these things. And so it's like it's much more effective.
So
It's a mesmerizing practice, but.
I just want to ask, in your experience, was there people who didn't have the capacity one way or another to absorb NVC, either because they don't actually have the empathy, I don't know, you know, yeah, to put themselves in someone else's shoes, or for, I don't want to say they didn't have the cognitive capacity, but you know, some people are, you know, maybe they don't, like, or for. So for what were the yeah were the, I there's no politically correct way to answer the question, so I'm just wondering
Oh.
to ask the question.
So we can just think about it. We have a diagnosis in psychology of the psychopathy or sociopathic, right? Sociopath, psychopaths,
Yeah, for
right?
example,
And
lack of empathy.
yeah, and that's the symptom we go for. You know, they just cannot tell what's going on inside another person. And there are very few people that have that symptom to the depth where it never is going to resolve, right?
So it can improve.
You never see those people in your classes, because
Okay, because they never turn up.
those people are not let out of their cells.
Okay,
The
okay.
prison system knows who they are, and they're like having a pet 26-foot anaconda, right?
Right.
At some point, the snake's going to get hungry and it's going to eat you. And it might have been your pet for 10 years, but it's not a personal thing to the snake. It's just hungry. So that's kind of what sociopathy and psychopathy is like, right? Right. You know it's going to happen.
Right,
So,
okay.
yeah. So if you want to be a
You take
person,
appropriate approaches.
yeah, if you want to be a person that treats people like that, right? It's going to take you a long time with just one person to do the job. I think it's inevitable that when they start receiving empathy, that their bodies respond. It may be like, you know, thawing steel when, right, to do it. But so I just decided to play a different game. I wanted effectiveness in my teaching. And so I decided to
Well,
teach people who merely have messed up. They might have messed up badly, but they had some openness, and then put them in group fields where they have a lot of opportunity.
Yes, and you know, I think as a society, we need to be looking for the low-hanging fruit if we're going to
Sure.
change this planet, because we can always come round to the tough nuts to crack once we've made the rest of the society unicorns and rainbows and things like that. Because that 26-foot anaconda might want to go out and play with the unicorns and the rainbows and the sunshine once, you know, everyone else is come round to a better place. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up?
Oh no, what you it, it's your party.
Well, I mean, I feel like You definitely made it your part. You're such an engaging speaker. I'm so interested in everything you had to say. But I hope everyone, I'm sure everyone listening felt the same. Fred, it's been really great to have you on Be Yourself and Love It podcast. Perhaps we'll speak again. You at home, be yourself, but no, just be yourself. Be yourself and love it.